Welcome to the First Things podcast. In this episode, we'll catch up with Michael Hannon, whose blockbuster First Things feature about sexual orientation shocked all the right people 2 years ago, and who is now a vowed religious with a few opinions about gender and sexuality. Facebook's 71 gender options, too much or not enough. Then, First Things editor Rusty Reno will recap a great debate on immigration between Catholic theologians, and he'll let us in on a diabolical plan he's hatched involving Howard Zinn. I'm associate editor Julia Yost, and I'm joined on both segments by literary editor Matthew Schmitz. Thanks for listening. In our March issue in 2014, First Things published a feature article by Michael Hannon titled Against Heterosexuality. Hannon argued that our familiar dichotomous account of sexual orientation is an invention of the late 19th century, and that debunking this account and the moral conclusions that harmonize with it is anthropologically truthful and strategically useful for Christian moral teaching. Safe to say, the article made a splash. Writing in Slate, Mark Joseph Stern opined, "Against heterosexuality is one of the most alarming anti-gay polemics I have ever encountered, and it provides a valuable glimpse into religious conservatives' next plan of attack, gay denialism." Meanwhile, Hannon himself has gone on to higher things. He is now in formation with the Norbertine Fathers of St. Michael's Abbey in Orange County, California. He goes by Frater Urban. He occasionally graces the island of Manhattan. This week, he is in town to give a lecture at Columbia University. He's sitting down with us to reminisce about his old bombshell and to brief us on his current projects. Frater Urban, good to see you.
Great to be here. Thank you, Julia.
I'm also joined by Matthew Schmitz. Frater Urban, let's start with Against Heterosexuality. Could you summarize your argument and give us a sense of where it came from and why you thought it was worth making?
Sure. So the article came actually after many other articles over a couple years, kind of wrestling with this topic, from a dissatisfaction with the way in which we had approached the issue as a Christian people, and especially as a church. And what I came to realize over the course of lots and lots of debates with people who agreed, people who disagreed, all these things about the ethics of the various issues in question, was that, unfortunately, the conceptual scheme we were using to try to wrestle with it was one that in the end was not terribly helpful for understanding either the ethics of the situation or the lived experience of people wrestling with these things. So what the article attempted to do was take us, in a certain way, back to the Catholic tradition and back to a Catholic conceptualization of the issues in question. But it did that in basically the same way that I came to that over the course of these years of thinking about this, which was maybe strangely through the avenue of queer theory, and most especially through the writings of Michel Foucault and some of his disciples. And of course, this is kind of old hat, but Foucault's basic contention with regards to these things is that, of course, these are, in a certain way, cultural constructs and rather recent ones, and that our understanding of sexual identity and especially sexual orientation is one that, while it has certain precursors that you can look to try to understand where it came from, it actually, in its present form, has existed for a very, very short amount of time, kind of at most 150 years, but really in the way we think about it now, maybe at most 50 or 60 years. So the queer theorists, by pulling a Nietzsche, as it were, and revealing the genealogy of the thing, also, I thought, gave us a firm spot on which to stand to pull the rug out from the current kind of cultural debate about these inbuilt or at least essential, wherever they come from, essential facets of personality. And by arguing that, in fact, these things don't exist, or at least don't exist in the way in which they claim to, in the way we normally talk about them, it opened the door to understanding a way forward for our Catholic conversations about this issue in light of where it looks like the culture is probably moving in their own understanding of these issues.
Right. So on the one hand, the notion of debunking the category straight and gay probably doesn't sit well with a lot of people who have a traditional mindset because it sounds postmodern. But you point out that the gay-straight narrative actually doesn't comport very well with Christian sexual ethics because it tends to essentialize sexuality as identity. And once you accept that, it becomes difficult to avoid characterizing Christianity as hostile to a category of people, as condemning sinners and not just a sin.
Right. So the kind of irony of that is that the system originally was created by people trying to defend heterosexual practices, but any heterosexual practice. So basically the idea was, as long as your partner is of the opposite sex, anything you're doing is fine. And they, in other words, created this framework as a way of scapegoating everyone who was committing the sins that this group was not particularly interested in committing. But the framework that they helped craft, and this is Freud amongst others, of course, didn't have any principled reason for that preference of opposite sex over same sex, because it had cut out the whole point of the matter, which is children, which is family life. And therefore, what it essentially leads to, even though this was exactly the opposite of their intention, was the current kind of anything goes libertine position of, well, why should we preference any of these? If you have the desires, act on them.
You know, if we're moving beyond these categories of heterosexual and homosexual, should I then say avoid describing myself as one of those two things, as gay or straight, if the question is put to me? Should one refuse those terms, or what do you have kind of,
so in general, kind of,
is there a practical upshot to this?
In general, I would certainly encourage people to excuse themselves from that categorization in either direction. I do think it's very important for us to defeat, even just in personal conversations in a kind of ad hoc way, to defeat this default schema for understanding sexuality wherever we get the chance to. Now, that said, I don't think there's a moral absolute about this. And prudence is going to be kind of messy in particular in all of these circumstances. To use an analogy that won't map on perfectly, but as a Norbertine, as a canon regular of Premontre, the kind of religious that I am in the Catholic Church is a canon. But no one today knows what a canon is. So we as a community discuss a lot, do we introduce ourselves as monks to people? Which is ironic, because when we were founded, monks and canons were in a very epic battle about the superior form of religious life. So Bernard of Clairvaux would get a huge kick out of me introducing myself to someone as a Catholic monk, as a canon regular. But the answer, and this is another one where I very much try to and encourage our brethren to identify as canons, I think reintroducing that terminology into the church is very, very important, because I think as canons, we serve a very important role in the church. But at the same time, when I meet someone on the elevator of a hotel here in New York who I have 30 seconds with, who looks at me and says, "What are you?" To be honest, I'm probably going to say, "I'm a Catholic monk." And I'm going to do that because I don't have time or, frankly, any reason in this conversation to deal with that. There are probably cases similarly where, even just for the sake of avoiding a certain kind of scandal in certain conversations where the understanding level just isn't there and won't be able to be established, where for convenience, maybe it's okay to label yourself as straight or as gay or whatever, if circumstances kind of demand that. But I'll say that I have not used either of those terms to describe anyone I know in several years now. And to me, it doesn't seem that hard to avoid that. And the liberal culture actually is pretty willing to dispense with those most of the time now, too. or at least to be kind of understanding when you try to, which is interesting in itself. But
right. So what are your thoughts on Facebook's 71 gender options?
Not enough.
Well, in a certain sense, I think that's true, Matt. Not enough if what we mean by gender is this kind of comprehensive, exhaustive account of personality that tries to trace itself back to the cosmic masculine and feminine in their infinite number of possible iterations of combination and, yeah, describe everything about who I am based on these kinds of labels. If everything about me is supposed to be not just intelligible in terms of, but even reducible back to my sex, male or female, then yes, male and female are never going to be adequate, and we're going to have to keep adding. And therefore, we're going to end up with a lot more than 71. We're probably going to end up with as many people as there are in the world, or more, because that kind of thing changes over the course of a lifetime anyway. So I think that is a kind of parody that shows very nicely why our too simplistic framework that we've been working with in the modern period is just not adequate for the messiness of the reality. And I think the Catholic moral tradition, and you look at things like casuistry, you look at handbooks for confessors from throughout the tradition, I think our categories for understanding actions, but not persons as reducible to those actions or desire for any of those actions at any given point, is a much more flexible way of dealing with this. So in that sense, even while I think, and this not just in the realm of sexuality, even while Catholicism is certainly essentialist in a very important way, Catholicism also is very open to the flexibility of the postmodern. And I think that combination gives us at least a power and maybe even a credibility in the modern public square to engage with these issues in a way that forces people to rethink the ways in which they understand what we're talking about.
You wrote a follow-up essay to Against Heterosexuality in which you expand on the following point. Chaste friendship is, in your opinion, superior to sexual union because, quote, it is totally ordered to the best things without divergence from below. And so you advocate religious communities as, quote, the ideal context for chaste friendship, a celibate common life ordered to union with God. The relationship between religious brothers or sisters is even more intimate than that between spouses. And now, of course, you're a member of a religious order, the Norbertines. So let's talk about your life now. First of all, why the Norbertines? What are they about?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question and one that's kind of tough to answer, not for reasons all that different conceptually from the sexuality stuff we've been talking about, but the categories we use to understand religious life today don't really answer to what we are as an order, as a community, because we were basically founded so long ago that the notion of order didn't really exist, and certainly the notion of charism didn't exist in the same way. So,
when were you founded?
We were founded in 1121, is usually the date given, sometime right around there, in northern France. The official name of our order is the Canons Regular of Premontre. Even the name Norbertine, while we accept it and we love our founder, is kind of anachronistic in the sense that at the time we were founded, it wasn't about Norbert or a particular founder or some one particular man that everything was given to and based upon. That's kind of a, and this isn't a bad thing, but a kind of Jesuitical notion that we now read back into our own history, which is fine. But it's funny trying to peg a charism for our order, because when we think about charisms, normally we're thinking about what is the one facet of the Christian life that is really exemplified and magnified by this particular community. What is their thing, their shtick, their charism? And the Norbertines don't have that at all. So Norbert founded our order not to be some one particular thing within the church for a few people. Norbert founded the community of Premontre to show all priests of the church, this is what the priestly life looks like. And Norbert could do that with a lot of experience behind him because he had lived as a very sinful cleric for a very long time before his kind of Augustinian conversion, and then before St. Augustine himself appeared to him and gave him his rule for us to follow. But basically what we are is just what the original priests, the original apostles were when they lived together in Jerusalem with the Mother of God. So we're priests who share a common life. Our most important work is prayer, is most especially the liturgy, the public prayer of the church, Christ's own prayer. But then from that kind of common life, and especially that common liturgical life, we go out and act as priests. And that means whatever the local church needs priests to be doing. So our monastery happens to be especially concerned with education, which is great. We run a boys' boarding school out of the monastery. We teach at other schools and are chaplains at various schools. But the order as an order is not specifically about education. They're just about being priests. So in some places that means mission work. In some places that means a lot of prison ministry, which we do prison ministry as well. But it's basically just we're there for the local church where the local church needs priests. But what sets us apart from most priestly life today is that it comes from that common monastic foundation. So we wake up every morning and are chanting the Psalms together at 5:45 a.m. and having our conventual mass and doing all these things before we then go out and live a lot of our day doing apostolic work in that very precise sense of the work of the apostles, priestly work for God's people.
Now, Michael, going back to the discussion of against heterosexuality, your essay, it seems to me that the thing you're advising is to discard these terms by which people today are filling out their identity in a really substantial and an important way, and to be able to say, I'm gay or I'm bi. You know, these are ways of, you know, filling our lives with a content, giving them a real shape. So if we don't have those categories, is there something else that you're proposing instead? I mean, how can one just shuck off all these terms? There has to be something else by which we then are ordering our lives.
So I would say two things. One,
we're thinking about ourselves less, it seems. It seems like you're telling us to think less about ourselves. So then what are we thinking about?
Very good. There's two things I'd say about that, and I think you hit the nail on the head at the end. One, it's true, we do need better terms for understanding ourselves, and I think those terms are provided for us very well by our Catholic tradition. There's kind of very obvious, essential, universal ones for Catholics that apply to everyone, like baptized, like saved, like sinful, like redeemed, like loved by God, like his child, like Christ's brother and friend. All of these are incredibly important. But I think you're also right that in large part, what I'm advocating comes down not just to replacing identity terms with other identity terms, but to thinking less of ourselves and being serene with the lack of serenity we feel in not knowing what we are or who we are or having a real grasp on ourselves. And I think coming to terms with who we are, figuring that out and living with it and modifying it and growing is a lifelong process, and frankly, much more than a lifelong process. And that's not unimportant, but I would say that I think the need to grasp onto something that says, this is me and I can give a kind of clear and concise account of that, that makes it unnecessary for me to sit in uncertainty and be serene with a lot of questions, that is the cross in a real way. We are not going to know what we are finally or who we are finally in this life. And we're also not going to know who anyone else is in an exhaustive way. And that can be very, very frustrating.
Now, while you were away, locked in an abbey, and I'm sure harrowing circumstances, you weren't writing for us, alas, but a mutual friend of ours did write something. And I think he mentioned that you had referred him to the book that he wrote up by Dom Chapman. Now, does this play into your account here?
Very much so. I actually just recommended this book. It's called Spiritual Letters by Abbot Chapman, John Chapman. He was a Benedictine about 100 years ago. I just recommended this book over lunch, actually, to an atheist friend of mine. So we'll see how that goes. But this book, I think, is incredibly important. It's probably the most important thing I read in my novitiate outside of sacred scripture. This is a collection of writings by a Benedictine abbot to various people in monasteries or in the world about prayer, especially. And he didn't write them as a book. He just wrote letters to people, and his correspondences were published after his death. But I remember the first letter, it's maybe half a page, where he's just writing to someone, and you don't know what she's written to him, but he's responding to a woman and saying, "I think the peace you're looking for is not attainable in your circumstances, but there is a higher, better peace that comes from simply willing what God wills," which is to say, simply willing things the way they are, the story he's telling, even when it makes absolutely no sense to us, that is a much higher order peace that our feelings may never catch up with, and that's okay. But there's a kind of higher order serenity that comes with loving providence and actually willing providence as your own in union with God that is the spiritual life. I mean, Mother Teresa was canonized last week. You want to talk about an excellent example of this. This is a woman who lived in darkness for decades, but whose will at the highest point in her soul, the point that, with lots of qualifications, really just is the Holy Trinity, she lived with that totally united. So Chapman's talking very particularly about prayer, but you can extrapolate from this to life. Experience is always going to be inadequate for understanding or judging prayer. Prayer is encounter with God, and God is too big to fit into your senses, so you're not going to feel that. You might feel something, but whatever you feel will not itself be prayer, will not itself be God. So Chapman's account would be that we need to live by something much higher than our experience. And especially in prayer, especially when we go to God to meet him there and stop doing anything else and just give him ourselves, we may feel nothing. We may feel like we're doing absolutely nothing. Nothing may apparently come from it. Great. It's not about that. And if you feel like nothing's coming from it, that's even more purifying and an even better opportunity for you to show God, "Great, here am I. This feels awful and useless. I'm going to stay anyway." And I think that prayer ends up being a microcosm of the Christian life in this regard. The Christian life is very much a life of, I don't get it, I don't feel it, I feel awful, or I feel great, whatever, I feel whatever I feel. That doesn't seem to answer to what I know to be true most days. Okay, you're not going to feel it. This is exactly what Christ told us at the resurrection, after the resurrection. Blessed are those who do not see and believe. And we will see, but not yet.
I had a cheeky concluding question about your best Foucauldian analysis of St. Michael's Abbey. It no longer seems fitting. Joined now by Rusty Reno and again by Matthew Schmitz.
Rusty, this week you visited St. Charles Borromeo Seminary in Philadelphia to deliver a lecture on immigration. Actually, you and another Catholic theologian, Peter Casarella from Notre Dame, delivered dueling lectures on immigration from a Catholic perspective. You, I believe, arguing for less of it and he arguing for more of it or more hospitable policies.
Right.
Could you give us a blow-by-blow and also the final score?
Right. Yeah, Peter, I was actually his roommate my second year of grad school. He was his first year grad student. So our arguing goes way back. Peter holds a view, which I think is the Episcopal Conference's view, And that is it's not open borders, that would be unfair, but a presumptive hospitality towards immigrants. And he spoke about a natural right to immigration. And this is a kind of a way in which a lot of Catholic thinkers are thinking about immigration, sort of preferential option for the immigrant. I argued in my talk for a preferential option for one's fellow citizens. And I think that's that. So do we really disagree? I mean, certainly we disagree about what in moments where political leaders have to make hard decisions. I think Peter and I disagree about what direction the Catholic Church says these political leaders ought to tilt. He argued for tilting in the direction of the stranger, the sojourner. I argued for tilting in the direction of the people with whom we already have a special bond and special duties and responsibilities. Did I win? I don't know. We didn't have a vote. It was not an Oxford Union debate. I would say that I have a kind of easier time of it. In some sense, Peter had on his side lots of very vivid biblical images. Jesus was a refugee in Egypt, and there's also the wayfarer and the sojourner that the Old Testament urges the people of Israel to give special consideration to. But I had on my side, I guess, human nature, and that I think people have a natural desire to be part of a particular community of people. And when you speak about, in a balanced way, when you speak about the need of our national communities to preserve and transmit to the next generation a distinctive heritage, I think most people resonate with that.
So, globalizing economic forces are weakening the nation state right now. But there are also sort of critiques of the nation state that are more theological in nature and right. That go back much longer than the current wave of globalization. Did that come up at all in your talk?
No, but I think it is important, and it probably is on the horizon of Peter's thinking. Certainly Bill Kavanaugh at DePaul University is probably the most powerful spokesman for a view of the nation state as a modern invention, or if not a modern invention, certainly it's something that came to the fore in the modern era as a substitute for the church as the organizing principle for public life. So the Westphalian system of the nation state that emerged after the wars of religion becomes the kind of secular form of Christendom. And Bill thinks that that's a kind of idolatrous, it encourages an idolatrous nationalism. And I would say yes, obviously 1914 to 1945 was a period of civilizational crisis in the West that did turn on disordered nationalist passions to some extent, and also ideological passions. And I think if I had come of age in that era or in the immediate aftermath of that, I would have signed on, as did the Catholic leadership, as did people like Jacques Maritain, I would have signed on to a weakening project. But I didn't come of age in that era. Instead, I came of age in the 1970s. And in the post-60s environment, everything was subject to critique. And so I think we live in an era not of undue hot passions for collective loyalties, but in a period of skepticism, cynicism, and increasing disloyalty to common institutions. So I think the church is pushing, I think Pope Francis is just pushing in the wrong direction. He follows in that tradition of the post-1945 tradition of critiquing strong passion and passions that can weld people into dangerous forms of solidarity, whereas I think very little is joining people in solidarity. And as a result, the very thing that Pope Francis fears, which is a sort of empire of utility, winds up meeting no resistance, because really you need to have natural forms of solidarity to counterbalance the abstract nature of capitalism.
Now, Rusty, I think of Archbishop Supich's comment that anyone who opposed the recent effort at comprehensive immigration reform was standing against God's agenda. You know, those are hard words, and as someone who opposed that, they fall on me. I think too of how they fall on other people who occupy different places on the political spectrum than I do. Bernie Sanders opposed an effort at comprehensive immigration reform right. because it included a guest worker program that stands counter to the idea that people who come to this nation end up becoming citizens. You know, it would bring people in for a certain period of working and then send them back to whatever country they came from. And Sanders opposed this because he thought it gave capital an advantage against labor. And as a leftist, he opposes that. So you say we're living in this age of moving beyond national loyalties. One of the ways in which we're moving beyond national loyalties.
We're in danger of that.
Yeah.
It's up in the air now. I think it's become a very hot political issue as a result.
It's contested. Whether or not we manage to move beyond them is an open question. But one way that we're attempting to move beyond them is by the corporate monopolization of social, political, and moral prestige. So, Apple becomes this paragon of gay rights. Uber is transforming society in a way that no government can. And corporations are variously applauded by people on the left or the right. Corporations, they like, they want lots of labor. So one question is by presenting, you could form a leftist kind of analysis saying comprehensive immigration reform, lots of low-skilled labor is good for corporations, and it's now being presented as very morally prestigious. You have to favor this, and if you don't, you're a bigot, just as you are if you oppose some of the other things that corporations are now very strongly supporting. They're doing BDS in North Carolina, boycott, divestment, and sanctions on an American state. So if Catholic bishops say that we have to support these bills that are favored by all the largest corporations, and if we don't, then we're bad Catholics or Christians, whatever it may be, are the bishops just becoming chaplains to capital?
No, I think that's a great observation, and it's a testimony to how disorienting the current moment is for all of us, that Apple would present itself, and the Silicon Valley in general, this great engine of wealth creation, minting billionaires, it seems, every quarter, that they should present themselves as a progressive force for transforming the world and making it more just and is really very odd. That was not the way I think businessmen would have thought of themselves in the 1950s or 60s or 70s or 80s. So we are in kind of a new moment there, and I do worry that Catholic leaders are naive about the transformations of our society globally. And I think the Pope can be especially, he said of himself, I'm both savvy and naive. And I think he is both of those. But the times when he's naively endorsing what I think are the very forces of globalization that he decries elsewhere, I just want to tear my hair out.
Now, people often talk about the economic costs of immigration, and it's debated, does it depress working class wages, does it not? But I'm not convinced that people's worries are primarily economic when it comes to immigration. I think it's a cultural anxiety. It's not just about hatred of the other culture and a simple desire to assert our own. It's also a feeling of abandonment. People worry that the leaders aren't committed to their own culture. They respect, when I grew up in rural Nebraska, always would be these discussions about immigration, and people would say, those Hispanics, they work hard.
Yeah. Right.
And there was great respect for that. But what they didn't like was the notion that, English wouldn't be, there wouldn't be a confidence in the culture that was receiving them, that English wouldn't be held up as the official language. And, there's something, absurd about these efforts to, enshrine English or what have you, but it expresses a real desire for the political leaders to be responsive and responsible to a broader political community.
Well, I think, yeah, I agree. And I think immigration is often the emblem for deeper anxieties about the future and whether or not the place that you're from is going to be recognizable in the future. And we all have a desire to be from somewhere. I mean, nation comes from natus. It's, you know, our birthright in a metaphysical way, in a mythic way, and not just in an economic way. And we live in a time when our political leaders really default towards economic analysis of almost everything. And that actually does not reassure. So even
that's part of the problem.
That's part of the problem. So it actually is it reinforces people's anxiety that their political leaders are not committed to sustaining something.
Any thoughts about the European situation? We've talked about France on a previous podcast. What about Angela Merkel and her escapades in Germany?
Right. Well, you know, certainly Merkel is worried about returning to the 20th century and any hint or rumor of a preserving German nation or state.
Yes, Germans are particularly vulnerable.
It's a terrifying thing. But you know what will the cost of that guilt or the reaction to the 20th century be? It doesn't. There's no plan of integration that I can perceive. You know, there are guidelines explaining why sexually assaulting a woman is not to be
right.
done. But there's not a real plan for integration, and so that seems to be a failure of leadership to welcome people into a country, but not actually welcoming them in, bringing people into a territory, but not having any conception of how you can make them part of that whole, or at least a whole that people can recognize. You know, is a mere invocation of diversity
right.
enough? Is that enough to form the basis of a nation?
You know, Gaudium et Spes, the pastoral constitution from the Second Vatican Council, talks about the importance of globalization and affirms it. But it also was written in a time of decolonization in the 50s and 60s. And there's a strong affirmation of a right to the development of one's own culture. And I just don't understand why the Vatican doesn't have more sympathy for Dutch or Danish or French or Germans who are worried that they won't be able to sustain their own culture amidst a dramatic demographic transformation of their society, especially with Islam. I was at a meeting about a month ago, and there was a French woman, very passionate intervention in a debate about immigration, where she made the observation that the Muslims who in her neighborhood go back to Morocco and Algeria every year for about a week to their village, to their homeland. And she says, if I lose France, I'll have nowhere to go. That was a very powerful expression of anxiety about being homeless. And so I just don't understand why the Pope Francis doesn't recognize this parallelism. I mean, immigration without the intent to assimilate is colonization. That's what colonization is. And to invite people to colonize is treason. I mean, for a political leader to invite people in whose intent is to colonize, I would describe that as an act of treason. Now, these are very harsh words that I'm using in order to, I think, draw out for listeners what I see as the dynamic that is roiling European politics right now. And it's an emblem for a deeper sense that the global system is emerging and our elites are transferring their loyalty away from the national project and towards the global project.
Rusty, to your point about the responsibility of political leaders to foster or support a proper patriotism, I once heard you propose something along the lines of banning Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States.
Not banning.
Okay, well, tell us about this.
Burning?
Okay.
It just strikes me as, you know, especially in this current environment, it's just an act of political insanity to promote essentially a negative view of the American project that someone like Howard Zinn does. If you are concerned that we have a nation that is more open to immigration it strikes me that you have to precisely in that moment reinforce for ordinary people a sense of pride in the national project and reassure them that you as their leader are committed to that national project. When a school board requires the Howard Zinn book for American history in 11th grade, it's sending a message. As your community leaders, we are deeply embarrassed by the American project. Look, you got the Obama administration willing to defund school districts that don't have transgender bathrooms. Good grief. I mean, objection, Your Honor, relevance to anything of any importance for the future of our country. And at the same time, they don't give any attention to what I think are the dissolving, corrosive effects of a kind of crude, self-flagellating multiculturalism.
So as a political gambit, this would be sort of equivalent in your mind to the transgender bathroom gambit. It's something that kind of...
Symbolic.
Yeah. Symbolic. But energizes people on your side.
Oh, I think it would. I think it could energize if it's presented in the right sort of way. Well, one of my friends who is, his parents are Chinese immigrants and grew up in California, who's a particularly pugnacious personality, when he was in 11th grade, he objected to this textbook on the grounds that it made his parents look like idiots for having moved to the United States, immigrated to the United States. And he got, his history teacher was very angry at him for raising these objections to what is otherwise obviously a moral and noble project of critique.
I have a Howard Zinn quote here, but it's stupid, so I'm not gonna read it.
Is anything in his book quotable?
Probably not.
That's all for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to my colleagues, Rusty Reno and Matthew Schmitz. Special thanks to Frater Urban Hannon. And thank you, listeners.